lady teacher is teaching the things that they needed. If you teach them, that's fine. But here we see it's all mixed up. They show everything. And today we have seen, like, they bring two men next to each other and they say, this is a husband and this is wife. You know, yeah. This media, this society, the main role, the society has the main role. This violence is happening because of the society, because of those who think that the modernization is something new and which is advancement. This type of modernization is taking you back towards the Stone Age.
I don't think people are violent against women because of modernization. It's kind of a...
No, the modernization has a big role in it.
It's been happening for thousands of years. In fact...
It is happening, but it wasn't on this scale. That's the point.
I'm thinking it's become less now compared to the past. In the past. Husbands...
How can you?
To beat their wives all the time. In fact...
You're just looking at one aspect of things. Yes. The beating is one thing. Abuse, rape, yes, or
addictions.
Kidnapping, addiction. Uh-huh. These are all things. We need to see all the aspects of the
society.
So
you're defining violence in a much broader term, yes, in terms of abuse.
We need to, obviously. Okay. It's not just about the husband meeting the wife.
At the moment, in that moment that he's eating it. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. What is behind it? What is the root cause?
And one more thing, that this modernization which it brought, you know, Islam has covered the woman into the veil. And this veil protects her. And when you take this veil from her, she's open to all.
Now, would you agree or disagree that in some Islamic cultures, right? And I know a personal case where I know someone who is actually being beat by their husband, and the girl's father actually supported the husband in this case, okay? Because they said that, you know, he's the husband, he has a right to do this. Or if you go to some countries, it's sometimes considered part of the culture to be able to do this, right? How do you address this issue that in Islamic culture, sometimes it's an acceptable thing to be able to beat your wife?
It's not just Islamic culture. If you go to Mexico, it's Hispanic culture. They eat pork and alcohol, and they have the same belief system. Uh-huh. It's a culture. It's not Islam, it's not a religion, and it has to do nothing with the religion. And this is a human nature, as I said before, and the brother mentioned, it was in the past existed, right? It depends on the character of the individual, how he treats the person in front of him. Mm-hmm. It's like you see some kids, they see a beautiful flower, they try to preserve it. You see some kids, they go and pick up all the flowers, they try to destroy all the things. It's a nature. It's a training. So when somebody is destroying, you have to teach them, train them how to preserve and protect. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. The female or the woman or the girls, they're the weak individuals. They're like the flowers. As a brother mentioned, you put the veil, you put the cover, you put the nets around them to keep them away from the bugs. So we have to teach our women, we have to teach ourselves in the society that we have to protect our females. The protection gives them the dignity. And the research and a lot of things they did, the women who covered themselves in Europe and the West, they're more protected compared to the women that are being exposed. And, you know, just the veil is a remembrance of something that Allah commanded for the female to put on their head. Mm-hmm. So even though, if you're a Muslim and you're a Chauvinist and you're backwarded and you're not trained how to treat the woman, you're going against the Sunnah of Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and you treat the woman wrongly, by seeing that hijab should be the sign. It should be the sign that this woman, it's the amanat. It's something that have to be protected by you. It's a responsibility for you.
I mean, one thing I think you mentioned is that, you know, it's very much related to culture, right? You mentioned it's, for example, in Mexico, I think you said, or in Hispanic culture, this is also something that happens.
Yes.
So we can see that strategies have been used to change culture, right? For example, things like you mentioned, like, you know, homosexuality was a crime and now it's become, like, normal. Or we see, I would say even... hitting children, you know, when I was growing up, kids would get beat up by their parents. But today, you know, people are against it. You know, you'll find there's so much awareness about this issue.
That's the media, basically. Huh? That's media. One more thing I need to mention is, why is it necessary to have, for example, the receptionist be a girl? You know, the air hostess to be a girl. And yes, they are working. They need to have a work, but, you know, they have the... You know, the big companies, if you go to them and you look at their expenses for the secretary or the boss's secretary or the receptionist, their makeup stuff is bought by the company itself. They're spending this much money on these things. Why? Is it necessity? So when you're basically showing off something or you're trying to portray something in front of public, obviously the man is weak.
Yeah, but I don't see a link between a woman working as a receptionist or secretary and violence being committed
against her. There is no relation directly, but indirectly there is a relation.
I don't even see the indirect relationship.
Okay,
I'm just saying, if somebody's working, how is there violence?
Like, no, for example, expectations. We are made by the expectation. You know, as brother mentioned, when you raise the expectation of the society of the female, and you said this is the icon, this is the icon, this is the woman. The woman should look like that, for example. Mm. And a lot of people, like a lot of brothers, like they're not happy in their homes because their ideology and the mindset has changed about who is the perfect woman. So instead of looking the role of the woman in the life, which kind of mother she is. Is she following the sunnah of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? Is she a good example, like Fatima Zahra? She comes, if she's going to love that woman, she's going to be proud of that woman, or that woman is somebody is just going to be a shame to the Muslim society. So when you change the iconic of the woman, and that you represent the woman, as brother mentioned, you spend the money and the makeup and for this female and be a secretary to be an image of the company.
What would you say? Okay, that might...
There is one more thing.
That might be an indirect link, okay?
we have even the cases that I've seen that there was divorce between the husband and wife just because the husband wasn't looking like that, for example, actor, and the wife wasn't looking like the specific female actor who was playing a role. So even these things are affecting the houses, the relation between husband and wife, because when husband, for example, a man, is watching a movie... and he thinks about a specific woman working in that or playing in that movie, he wants to see his wife like that because he likes that shape, maybe.
Yeah.
So these are the things that we need to think about.
In my view, like these things don't... They might be indirect links, or you're saying it has a psychological impact.
In general public,
the direct causes of this violence, right? For example, would you say that lack of education, for example?
Lack of faith, brother. It is lack of faith,
lack of education. We need to give awareness, especially in the Islamic cultures that you mentioned, for example, like in the Middle East or some Islamic countries, the husbands are beating their wife. We need to, obviously, they should be given awareness that Islam does not allow you to do this. The only reason is within the Muslim societies, we see that the Muslims, even they don't read Quran. They don't know what this Quran says. Because if they know what Quran says, they will not beat or hurt or do violence against their even wives. So this is the case. It's because of the ignorance that they have. They're not aware of these things. And obviously, in order to give awareness, there is a role of media, the role of government. The media, where it is showing a lot of things, it should show these things as well. It should convey this message as well, the message of Quran, that it is the religion of peace. You need to live in your house in a way that you serve your family. And obviously, we have the role models for us. For example, Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha, Imam Ali Alayhi Salatu Wasalam. These are the role models. We know about their life, their lifestyle. We should follow.
And I think, you know, one thing we should be aware of when we talk about this topic is that this topic is used as a switch and bait many times. I don't know if what I mean is that they'll present this topic for one reason, but it'll be used for something else, right? For example, feminism today in the West, they bring this topic, you know, the violence against women, which is something we need to talk about. But then they will leave that alone and then they'll take on their own agenda, right?
The problem with the feminism is that they forgot why they started. the first day feminism started because women were not allowed to work. So they started to protest that we should also be allowed to work. So in those cases, yes, they have their rights. Islam talks about their rights. But today's feminism is something else, which is extremely 180 degree against what it was started for, the reason it was started for. So basically, feminism itself is a problem.
So very interesting discussion, and you know we all have different points of views about this, but I think mainly we all agree that there needs to be more awareness about this. People need to know more about this, and ultimately, you know, we need to change our culture and society to help protect women from being
and empower the
being
woman.
Harmed. Yeah, and Islam is all about, you know, protecting women and protecting a woman's dignity, and It's all about respect and love towards all members of society, of course, not just women, children, elderly, everyone. Islam even cares about plants and trees and, you know, even the ant. So we just need to become more educated and aware about these issues. So thank you so much for listening to Back to Reality. Please continue listening to these episodes. Take care. Fi amanillah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Ministry.
Palestinian minors have suffered illegal Israeli incarceration since the start of 2020. The occupation forces continue to target young Palestinians across the occupied territories, with approximately 170 Palestinian children currently suffering behind bars. Palestinian minors from East Jerusalem get pulled out of bed in the middle of the night, needlessly handcuffed, and then made to spend a long time waiting for their interrogation to begin. Only when they are tired and broken are they taken in for lengthy interrogation sessions without being given the opportunity to speak to a lawyer or their parents before the questioning begins, and without understanding that they have the right to remain silent. They are then held in detention facilities under harsh conditions for days and weeks. In some cases, all this is attended by threats, verbal and physical abuse before and during the interrogation. Without the protection of their parents or even adults that they can trust, and in complete disregard for their youth, the boys have to endure this entire process alone, far from their families, away from their normal daily routine and anything familiar. No one explains to them where they are being taken, what they are suspected of, what their rights are, who they may confer with, how long the process will take, and when they will return to their families and homes. These practices have Israeli occupation forces free to use pressure to force them to confess. And indeed, many of the detained minors sign involuntary confessions of crimes they never did, which are then used as the basis for indictments against them. All for what? Well, this aspect of life in East Jerusalem cannot be separated from Israel's overall policy in the city. All Israeli occupation forces operating in East Jerusalem follow a policy aimed at encouraging Palestinian residents to leave the city. What better way to terrorize the public than by using their own children as bait? Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The use of force, nighttime arrests, questioning not in the presence of their parents, rides in patrol cars for intimidation and unnecessary handcuffing. These are just some of the violations of the rights of Palestinian minors detained by the Israeli occupation forces in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Taken in for lengthy interrogation sessions without being given the opportunity to speak to a lawyer or their parents before the questioning begins. Palestinian kids are then held in detention facilities under harsh conditions for days and maybe weeks. To discuss this issue with us from Palestine, from the West Bank, is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Wahdan. Now, Palestinian minors from both eastern part of Jerusalem and the West Bank are being pulled out of bed in the middle of the night. They are being unnecessarily handcuffed. They are being dragged for interrogation, sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks, away from their parents and away from everything that they really know, without the presence of lawyers. During the time of the incarceration, what options do their parents have to try and protect their children from all of this unnecessary terrorism?
Actually, the parents are forces. They can't actually do anything in front of this savage
raids and incarcerations of minors. The parents try to defend their children while they are at home or in front of their homes, but after the Israeli soldiers take them away, they can't do nothing except, you know, hiring lawyers or going to some human rights organizations to help them trace where their children are. So while in detention, they are kids are deprived totally from getting this legal assistance. Even the Red Cross sometimes takes them 1 to 2 weeks until they can meet their children. And during this time, the Israeli interrogators and the Israeli forces can't do anything with them. They can intimidate them, they can threaten them, blackmail them, and the kids have actually no, except for the knowledge that they get from their peers, but they don't have the legal knowledge to defend themselves. Actually, they are being in this battle on their own while in prisons.
So you're telling me, Dr. Wahdan, that in 2020 you have people coming over to your house, kidnapping your child at the middle of the night, taking your minor for interrogation for God knows what, trying to embezzle them and trying to terrorize them to make them maybe sign some papers that would later on be used as an indictment against them. If this is happening in the world, any other place in the world, the entire globe would go crazy. Why is Israel allowed to get away with this violation of basic human rights?
Well, if we compare what happens in the U.S. during Trump, or even before that, what happens to minors and what happens to minorities and people of color, mm-hmm. and how the authorities are treating them, how the police forces are treating them, we can get the picture very clear here. They have a free hand. You know, the interrogators, the police forces, the soldiers here have a free hand because they have a cover-up. And who is covering up their terrorizing and their criminal acts against Palestinian minors, women, old people? They have nothing actually to stop them because the U.S. is backing them up. And the rest of the NATO countries, the rest of the allied forces, which are led by the U.S., is defending them. The UN, actually, and international human rights has piles of cases that shows and is a solid evidence mm-hmm. of crimes that has been committed against minors, which do not get anywhere. All these reports, all these statistics that are sitting in the, you know, in the drawers and offices of the UN human rights offices do not get any legal, legal follow-up in order to put an end to these violations of human rights and violations of international law. So mm-hmm. Israel goes, you know, unpunished, unaccountable for all its crimes, killing youth, actually keeping the bodies of the martyrs of Palestinian children. Until now, we have like more than 50 bodies of children who have been martyred in 2015. And the families cannot get their, their bodies to...
There are a lot of scandals affiliated with these cases, with a lot of them being organ trafficking by the Israeli entity. But these practices leave the occupation forces, as you said, free to pressure the kids, the families, and to make them confess. And indeed, at some point, some kids actually sign involuntarily confessions, which are used basically basically they are written in a different language than that that they know, and they are obviously false ones, but the kids are intimidated to do so, which are then used as a basis of indictments against these kids, which could actually lead them to be behind bars for more than 20 years according to the age of the kid. But why bear all this cost? I mean, they're definitely paying a lot of money to do this. Why are they bearing all this cost? I mean, what young kids are confessing to crimes that they have nothing to do with? What are the Israelis actually achieving by this specific act of intimidation and terrorism?
Actually, they want to terrorize and intimidate the kids so they don't throw stones. That's the major, you know, the major accusations that they use against these kids. Because what else do they have except for throwing stones at the soldiers when they, you know, when they barge in into their homes or into their villages or into their olive yard fields? That's the only thing that they have. They want to defend themselves from the assaults of these soldiers or settlers. In this case, it's during this last, you know, during this season of olive picking, so many people have been, you know, documented as being targeted by settlers and by soldiers. And hundreds of trees has been uprooted or burned while the people are trying to protect it. But of course, they can't do much. And confession by kids at during interrogations is very famous for the best, like, 4 or 5 decades. Mm-hmm. They try to use this to force kids because, of course, they want to close the case and send them to prison. But with throwing stones, no, I don't think that there is any charge in the whole world that puts kids behind bars for throwing a stone. But of course, they fabricate allegations and accusations against these, peaceful kids who are trying to defend their olive fields or mm-hmm. trying to defend their fathers while they the soldiers trying to arrest their fathers. So these criminal acts or war crimes and crimes against humanity that are committed by the Israelis are not being accountable and not being addressed by the ICC, for example. Mm-hmm. Because to go to this court, you need years and years, and with lots of evidence, especially with martyrs, for example. We, in our case, our foundation, Sheikh Hassan Foundation, has been following some cases of martyrdom or even severe wounds by the Israeli soldiers, and it doesn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. It stays there.
It basically starts with the fact that Israel actually does not. It starts with the fact that Israel does not even recognize the ICC, for that matter, or any other international community, if you will, body, which I hate that word, by the way. It's just a couple of countries in the West deciding over what happens in our region, especially in occupied Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for speaking to us about the horrific incidents that the young people of Palestine, the youth of Palestine, is going through because of the Israeli occupation forces. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will talk about Lebanon. Now, as the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri falter, the media silence regarding the government formation directly and openly between the president of the country, Michel Aoun, and the prime minister designate Saad al-Hariri has changed from a positive issue in terms of preventing confusions to a negative issue after several weeks had passed without any hopeful signs emerging as gossip, rumors and misinformation multiplied without any clarifications being issued by those involved in the pressing file of government formation. Hariri stuck in government formation in Lebanon in this following report.
Lebanon is currently experiencing a gradual deterioration towards the abyss in light of its political stalemate, financial and economic hardships, and the lack of a support program from the international community as the required reforms have not yet been achieved. November 19 last week saw a sudden increase in the dollar exchange rate, which reached 8,200 Lebanese pounds on the black market before dropping slightly. The rate had dropped to under 7,000 Lebanese pounds less than a month ago when Saad al-Hariri was assigned to form a new government based on the French rescue initiative on October 22nd. However, that has yet to happen, with the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri faltered so far. Several factors have been influencing this trend. However, it is the external interference that is lock-jamming any political development in Lebanon, especially after the new U.S. sanctions imposed against the head of the Free Patriotic Movement, former Minister Gibran Basil, beginning with the continuous U.S. pressure on every prime minister designate so far to limit the representation of Hezbollah in the government formation process and to deny it ministerial positions despite the fact that Hezbollah has the majority in the Lebanese parliament. Add to that the external influence in the form of continuous Arab and Gulf messages to Hariri, making it clear to him that there will be no change in the currently adopted policy towards Lebanon and therefore no aid unless there is a change in the Lebanese government's dealing with Arab and Persian Gulf files. Mind you, all the while, the international community is also warning that Lebanon will not receive any kind of aid and financial loans unless it forms a new government that is trusted internally and internationally and is particularly capable of launching the much-needed reform workshop on various levels. Faced with this reality, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri is between a rock and a hard place. He feels obliged to succumb to external pressure while the internal political demands puts the future of the entire country on the line. A decisive week ahead for Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, he either fails to form a government or he will form one that resembles its predecessors in both form and terms of power and lose all foreign support.
Now with us to discuss this issue from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, who is an academic and a writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashebi. Now, observers of the Lebanese political dilemma believe that the external influence in the form of continuous U.S. pressure on Lebanon would be the main reason behind why Saad al-Hariri has failed so far to formulate a government, specifically as far as the U.S. openly aiming to limit the representation of Hezbollah and any of their allies at this point in the executive authority and to deny them what they call sensitive ministries, whatever that means. If that is the case, then can we say that actually there's no hope for anyone, even it's Hariri himself, to actually formulate a government in Lebanon with these pressures on the table?
Yes, well, unfortunately, amidst the crisis that we're going through in Lebanon, the economic crisis, the spread of the COVID-19 virus and the port explosion, amidst all this, I feel that, yes, there's a lot of international pressure and international interference in Lebanese affairs. In fact, the only initiative to move forward is a French initiative, not even a local one. And Mr. Hariri was designated as prime minister. He's finding it, he's having a lot of difficulties to form the government because there are demands apparently by foreign powers that are pressuring him not to have, Hezbollah represented in the government. Well, I think that what I heard in the recent days in Beirut is that there is no problem. This issue can be resolved easily. Hezbollah does not have to have ministers from its, party members. As members of parliament, we have to remember that Hezbollah is a party represented in parliament. So many people who voted for Hezbollah are not necessarily Hezbollah party members. Mm-hmm. So there are many supporters of Hezbollah who are not party members and who are not directly linked to Hezbollah, and they can be represented in the government. Now, this is making it more difficult for, some Western powers that are pressuring for, to deprive any representation of anyone who supports the resistance in the government. That's mm-hmm. practically impossible. So yes, there is a problem and there is a complicated situation here. There's a lot of external pressure, and Mr. Hariri perhaps doesn't have the actual power or the position to take a strong stance and refuse these or reject these external pressures on him, apparently.
We would add maybe more a bit to the external U.S. pressure, also to the pressure from the European countries, from the international community, to be honest with you, because they keep pressuring Lebanon, telling them that you will receive no aid, no financial loans whatsoever unless there's a government formed and unless that government is trusted both internally and internationally. I don't know why
it should be trusted
internationally, but in particularly capable of launching what they call the reform workshop on various levels. So it seems like one huge loop of inaction here. I mean, honestly, what options does Saad al-Hariri have at the moment as the country actually is heading to a financial disaster?
Yes, he has one main way to go forward if he wants to go forward or if he has the capacity to go forward, and that's a democratic process. There is a system in Lebanon. There's a constitution. And the prime minister, before forming the government, according to the constitution, has to do consultations with the various political groups and various coalitions in parliament and form the president based on their recommendations. Their recommendations are on the table. He knows the recommendations, and therefore he's supposed to form a government based on the constitution process. If he doesn't do that, I mean, he can actually face these European and Western powers by telling them, would you like a democratic process in Lebanon or a dictatorship? Now here is the situation. He puts them on the spot by saying, if you would like to have a democratic process, Hezbollah is a party that was voted in Lebanon democratically.
They were
European observers at that time when the elections took place. So therefore, Hezbollah is a representative of the people. I mean, if you don't like Hezbollah, you have to change people's votes. So maybe you can change the people's choices in the next elections. That's a different process. But
yes,
for now,
they've been doing this the wrong way by
sanctioning the entire country.
But let us dive a bit into the major internal difficulties here that's happening between certain parties and the Prime Minister designate, especially talking about the struggle between the Future Movement, which is headed by Prime Minister designate Hariri, and the Free Patriotic Movement led by former Minister Jibran Bassir.
What's that feud about? Well, I feel part of this kind of confrontation between the Future Movement and the Free Patriotic Movement is about power sharing. I mean, this is what we say in Lebanon, is that the country, one of the biggest flaws in the system, in the government system in this country, is that it's based on power sharing between the various communities, between Sunni Muslims and the Maronite Christians and Shia Muslims. And
Sectarian power sharing.
And that sectarian religious power sharing does not actually constitute as solid grounds for building a nation that is capable of having all the mechanisms of accountability activated, because the mechanism of accountability cannot allow some people who are doing corruption to hide behind their confessional identity, and that's what's happening in Lebanon. So they're doing this sharing between the various religious sectarian groups, and that does not build solid grounds for moving forward. I mean, and like Sayyid Abbas Mousawi said in the 90s, when the Taif agreement was passed, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi was the martyr who warned that the Taif agreement, since it is based, the constitution amendments that were done in the 90s, since they're based on power sharing by the different religious and sectarian group, they will actually lead to more problems and reach more disagreements between the various
sectarian
groups.
But something that's interesting, that we have less than 2 minutes here, I heard last week was from the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, John Kubis, who lamented the absence of functioning government in the country, especially in the aftermath of the deadly August 4th explosion, but he said that he had briefed the UN Security Council about the lack of progress in Lebanon. I mean, hold on a second. What does he mean? I mean, first of all, in what position is he to start giving such reports to the UNSC? That's one. And number two, is he basically signaling for a possible more role for the UN by the UNIFIL that are on the ground in Lebanon? That's very dangerous.
I don't think so. I think that maybe what we would like him to be meaning, I hope that he means the Security Council Resolution 242, 339, 194. These are Security Council resolutions that have to apply and that Israel has been violating for so long. Israel is the entity that has been violating international law more than any other entity in the whole region. So therefore, to actually talk about Security Council resolution...
What if he means the 1701, though?
Well, yes, let's... Okay, 1701 came
resolution.
After. I think we should go in line. 242, 338, 194 are resolutions that have been violated for... for more than 3 decades. So I think it is about time for these resolutions to start applying these resolutions, and then all the other resolutions will follow, and it wouldn't be necessary. Actually, I have to say something at the end, is that there wouldn't be any armed resistance if there was no
occupation. And aggression.
Exactly.
We still are not being able to implement the 425 resolution up until
425
now.
Was applied by the force of the resistance,
exactly,
according to chapter 7,
not
right
fully,
to resist.
If I may. We still have countries, countryside,
yes,
villages that are still occupied. I want to thank you very much for
this very, very
uplifting, first of all, conversation with you, Dr. Omar Nashebi, and hopeful for an upcoming government, if it might be happening in Beirut, to try and salvage what's left of the economy and the financial institutions in the country. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed the admission of the Western and Arab media and regimes under all-out support for the Iraqi dictator Saddam during the 8-Year War. He had imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the order of his masters in Washington and then Moscow. Stay tuned for more, please. The French intelligence agencies estimated in 1986 that if Paris had stopped sending aids to Iraq for 3 weeks, the Iraqi army would have been defeated in the war. As the United States, the Soviet Union, and their satellites had imposed the war on Iran to overthrow the Islamic system, they didn't spare any assistance to the Ba'athist regime in financial, arms, and political terms. This while they even refused to sell barbed wire to Iran. The US and European regimes, especially France, Britain, and Germany, delivered enormous amounts of chemical weapons to Saddam, which he used both against the Iranian combatants and a few towns. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the president of Iran in those days, would often go to the battlefronts since the first days of the war. He says on the end of the 8-year holy defense, "During the imposed war that lasted for 8 years, the US helped Saddam. NATO helped Saddam. The Soviet Union of those days helped Saddam, the reactionary Arab bloc, though it was very incompetent and weak, helped Saddam. Everyone helped Saddam. I mean, the East and the West had formed a single front for Saddam and against the Islamic Republic. Yet, the Islamic Republic didn't turn a hair. It stood and, with the divine help, overcame all of them and triumphed over all of them. After 8 years of war, they couldn't separate one span of Iran's soil." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, analyzing the Iranian people's exemplary steadfastness during the 8-year holy defense, says, "The Americans' aim of imposition of the war was to defeat the Islamic Republic by Saddam, to cause it to lose its reputation and say, yes, the Islamic Republic government and the Islamic Republic system caused Iran to lose. But the contrary occurred. In all the wars of the past 200 years with another country, Iran had lost. Yet, this 8-year war is the first war and the only war that Iran has defeated the other side and has not lost. A single span of the soil has not fallen in the hands of the foreign country. This is the first war, quite opposite to what Americans had desired took place." James Beale, a specialist of the issues of West Asia, says in his book on the war that the Iraqi regime hoped that it could nip the Iranian revolution in the bud. The Ba'athist army had invaded Iran's borders 636 times before the outbreak of the war on September 22, 1980. Saddam initiated the invasion of Iran, saying that he would reach Tehran within 3 days. He waged an all-out war with 12 infantry divisions, 15 armed brigades, 4,500 tanks and personnel carriers, 360 jet fighters, and 400 helicopters, as well as full military equipment. Contrary to his wishful thinking, his criminal army was bogged down as it faced the stiff resistance of the valiant people of Khorramshahr for 35 days. Although the Iranian army had little coherence in those days, and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps had been established for less than 1 year and a half, the national unity among all walks of life helped people overcome difficulties little by little. One year after the invasion of Saddam's criminal army, Iran changed its strategy from defensive to offensive so that within 9 months, big swathes of occupied territories were liberated and Saddam's regime sustained crushing defeats. Without any doubt, the most important reason for those victories was the unmatched leadership of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Imam Khomeini's words and commandments were highly esteemed among people, especially the youth. There was a very profound bond between the Imam and the Ummah. This was the very matter that the enemies had neglected and, in fact, couldn't understand. Former head of the French spying agency, Comte de Morange, said on how much the West was scared of the Imam's leadership. Iran is one of the real powers of the region as it has huge oil reserves in its vast and populous territory. For thousands of years, this empire has been known as the dominant power in the entire region. Now, in the era of Ayatollah Khomeini, this power has multiplied manifold. The French official wrote in a message to Saddam, "As for this man, Imam Khomeini, be alert. Nothing is more dangerous than a forest that has caught fire, because strong winds will blow over it and the fire can spread to the intellectual borders and neighboring countries." The United States and its European and regional allies consider Iraq as the best choice for achieving their nefarious goals. The Iraqi Prime Minister in those days, Taha Yassin Ramazan, said, "This war is not for the 1975 Algiers Accord or several kilometers of land and half of Arvand River. This war is aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic regime." Lars Aspin, then head of the Armed Forces Committee of the American House of Representatives, also stressed that the U.S. strategic objective should be focused on stopping the expansion of Iran's radical Islamic revolution to the Arab world, even if it requires employment of military force.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Guidelines for Self-Examination. Dear brothers and sisters, we know our physical being requires maintenance. Similarly, our spiritual existence also requires some maintenance work. And that maintenance cannot be performed without proper examination. Today we're going to provide you with some guidelines for self-examination when it comes to your soul. Well, be intentional. Set aside a specific time to examine your own life. Find a place where you can be alone. Bring a Quran, a pen, and some paper. Expect Allah to show you things that need to be confessed and changed. You may choose to tell a friend or an Islamic scholar that you have set aside time to examine your life. You might ask them to pray for you and commit to share what God has shown you. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when any servant of His turns to Him, He opens up the doors of mercy and He assists and helps them. If you're trying to identify your spiritual illnesses and weaknesses, we all have it, right? This is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to help you if you are intentional. Number two, be specific. Be specific when evaluating and examining your deeds. Be critical and strict with yourself. Pick on minor things as well. Above all, questions your intentions. Purity of intentions is a prerequisite of spiritual purification. So if you are genuine, if you're being specific, and if you're being tough on yourself, this is certainly going to help you in examining your spiritual being. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing some guidelines for spiritual self-examination. We all need it. Just like we need physical examination, we need spiritual ones. And we gave you two guidelines before the break. Let's move on to the third one, and that is trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you are examining yourself for the right reasons, trust Allah and rely on His assistance. He is the one who guides. And remember that He does not leave His servants alone. No matter how sinful you are, no matter how many shortcomings you have, remember that Allah's door of mercy is open for anyone who sincerely repents and turns to Him. So when you're evaluating yourself, when you're examining yourself, make sure that you know that you're dependent on Allah, and He is the one who is going to assist you throughout this process. So this reliance and trust on Allah is very essential for the process. The fourth one is honesty. Brothers and sisters, be honest in your examination. How many times, you know, do we fool ourselves? Think about it, honestly. You know, last thing you want is that you tread on this path of spiritual examination and you start fooling yourself. You start justifying your shortcomings. No, don't do that. Be honest. If you intentionally keep yourself in darkness, remember, no one can pull you out of it. Last but not the least is determination. Well, are you determined for making changes and amends in your life? It is a question you need to ask yourself before you tread on the path of self-examination. Are you ready to drop the questionable habits that you may have? Again, ask yourself these questions and be determined that you are ready and open to make amends and changes in your life. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.